Hello, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I'm Carl from selfsufficienthub.com, and I'm here to talk about all things self-sufficiency. Sustainability and food security matters. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I hope you're all safe and well. And today, or rather this week, we have Julie back. Hello, Julie. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. Anything changed since last week?
Since last week, yes. We have more quail.
fantastic.
So we had a hatch of Celadon quail, and it wasn't very successful because the humidity was shocking, and we had all those thunderstorms the previous week, so it really messed with it. But I have learned from it, so there's that. But we got six chicks, which is great. So
it's a start.
Yeah, it's a start.
Yeah. So much of today is like a holdover or a follow on from last week. But there were a few things that we just didn't get around to chatting about that I really wanted to discuss with you. And, you know, one of them was your cornfield.
Yeah, I have a cornfield.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
Okay, so I don't know. I think this just comes down to your perspective on life and
how much imagination.
Caveat. So if you're picturing like rolling fields and, you know, that's not what this is. So it was January in the darkest depths of cold winter when it was miserable and it was dark in the morning, dark in the evenings. And we were thrown into homeschooling, which was horrific. And I think all of us got quite antsy about homeschooling very quickly, to be honest, because it was so prescriptive and it was just endless maths kind of worksheets and videos. So I tried where I could to get my kids out in the garden and doing something else, get some fresh air, do something practical. So we sort of went off piste and we created our own curriculum. And that's where the cornfield came from. So we decided to have a go at growing glass gem corn, which, for anybody who isn't familiar with it, there's kind of broadly speaking two types of corn. There's sweet corn, which is kind of edible on the cob, and then there's flint corn, which is hard and you can either pop it or you can grind it into flour. So glass gem corn is just a really, really pretty flint corn. And it's, have you seen it? I don't know if you've seen it, Carl.
No, I haven't. I've seen the pictures that you posted on Facebook.
Okay. But not what it will look like when it's finished.
No, I haven't. No, I have seen lots of different types of flint corn. So whether or not I've seen your particular variety or not, I'm not sure online. I've never grown it.
Yeah.
But is it a multicolored one? Is it? Or
it's beautiful. So it's like a real mosaic of kind of any color that you can imagine is thrown in there. And you don't know what you've got until you harvest it. And you harvest it really late. You wait for it to dry kind of on the plant, basically.
Yeah.
So it's a huge mystery all the way through the year, right until the point of harvest. So that's quite exciting. But for my girls, I basically dressed it up as, you can tell I've got a drama background. I dressed it up as rainbow popcorn. I said, nice. Do you want to grow rainbow popcorn? Well, those are their favourite words, let's be honest.
Yeah, who doesn't want to grow rainbow popcorn?
So they got really excited about it. It's hard to get excited about growing in the middle of winter. So I was like, let's do rainbow popcorn. So we didn't have an appropriate space to grow it in because we've got some raised beds in the back, which are quite high raised beds. And we were only just thinking about establishing some kind of perennial mixed edible ornamental borders in the front, which are more kind of decorative but functional. And they weren't really up and running yet. And I was kind of looking around thinking, I don't know where to put this and we don't have an allotment. So we just put it plonked right in the middle of the lawn in the front garden, which for some people is probably a really mad thing to do. But it's actually worked out really, really, really well. So because you have to grow it in a grid formation because of the way that it's air pollinated.
Yeah.
So we marked out our square. And actually, I say we marked it out. I got Felicity doing it because that was her maths lesson for the day.
Perfect.
So she measured out the square, and then we got cardboard and we weighed it down with bricks. And then we left it for months. And then when spring finally happened, we got a load of basically kind of half broken down chicken manure from the back, and we put that on, and then we covered it with several inches of compost. And we, yeah, we, the girls and I germinated the corn indoors because it was such, because you have to get it started really, really early. And then it got too big for the house before the weather warmed up in that classic way.
Well, the weather just never broke, did it, this spring?
No.
It just went on and on and on, waiting for the temperatures to rise.
We picked a really bad year to try doing more kind of exotic growing, I think, because of the spring we had. When something like this, where you need to have a really long growing season, I was a bit worried that we're going to lose it all. And I think if it hadn't broken when it did, give it another week and we probably would have had a flop, basically.
So
we got lucky, and our germination rate was insane as well. We were really, really fortunate. So we've got 25, yeah, 5x5, so timetables as well, we've got all that in. So we've got 25 plants in this grid in the front garden, and I think the last time that I shared a photo of it was about nearly 2 weeks ago, and it was about waist height. Today it's way above my head. It's just
wow.
Yeah, it's, I mean, some of the ones on the outside were the smaller ones, and they're still probably about waist to chest height. But the ones in the centre are towering over me now. They're absolutely
fantastic.
Huge.
They're a little bit ahead of mine then.
It's a mix, because we had a mix of growth rates, and for some, I don't know why, we just mutually agreed we'd put the tallest ones in the centre of the square. We probably should have put them to the back away from the sun. That would have been more logical. But
I can see the thought process of protecting them from the wind, maybe.
Yeah, there is that. We had some sort of logic, but I think there were better logics we could have used. But anyway, it looks pretty. It looks quite grand.
Yeah.
But yeah, it suddenly shot up, and it's absolutely huge. I went from thinking, oh, this won't work because it's such a huge, long project to invest in, to now actually getting really, really excited, and I can't wait until the silks emerge, and we're probably going to help with the pollination just to make sure that we get as good a chance of a crop as possible. I think go on.
Well, all I was going to say was just before before we go much further away from pollination, you've mentioned already that obviously with sweet corn you plant in a block instead of a row. I just thought it might be worth touching on the reason for that. Would you like to elaborate?
Yes. So it's because they are wind pollinated. So to get the best chance of them pollinating, if you plant them in a grid, then you're more likely to get a really nice distribution of that pollen, and it will be captured within that space rather than just floating off across your front garden, as it would do in my case.
By wind pollinated, we mean that the pollen literally gets blown from one plant to another. And if they're all in a row, then you could imagine that sometimes that pollen is going to get blown just away from all your crops if you've got the wind blowing through your row rather than along your row, then you're not going to get
lost
any pollination at all. Yeah,
exactly. So but I was looking on just some random YouTube videos, as you do, to learn about what we were doing. And farmers who are selectively breeding, because you can do great variations with flint corn, I'm discovering, they'll actually use these specially designed little paper bags that they pop over the top of the male part of the plant and over the female parts until they're ready. And then they've gathered all of that pollen, and then they make sure it goes exactly on the corn crop that they want it to go on, which is intensive and extreme. And we're not doing that. We'll probably get some kids' paintbrushes and help it along and dust it onto the silks. And that's as much for the girl's benefit to feel involved in the process as anything else, to be honest.
Have you grown corn before, Julie?
Never. No, this is so outside my comfort zone. This is completely different.
Well, I have a couple of times, and I have to say, we've never made any special effort to pollinate, and we've never, ever, ever had any issues with it. Obviously, we plant in a block, but other than that, we've found that there are. But again, I'm talking about the sweet corn varieties. But I imagine that there's no difference. If anything, it might even be easier for the pollination. Yours is more of like a heritage breed, isn't it?
It is. So it's got a really, it's heritage, but it's new heritage. It's got an interesting history to it. So I cannot remember the name of the guy, but he's probably, anyone who knows anything about this will go, oh, it's him. But he was somebody who I think he was connecting with his own personal heritage, his own history. And he did so, he's from America, and he did so through the medium of learning about different corn varieties and how for First Nation Americans, they all tend to have their own particular variety related to their own tribe. And so, so he was kind of researching that and helping other people to regain their lost kind of heritage through corn. And in doing so, he developed this particular type. So I think there's a lot of kind of history surrounding that, but I literally kind of touched on the surface of it, but I thought it was quite interesting. So yeah, I like anything with a story, to be honest. If there's a bit of a story to it, it makes it more exciting to grow.
Yeah, and I know that from our conversation last week and before that you are very much an advocate for seed sovereignty, and you're trying to, obviously not in this case, but in a lot of cases, you're trying to use, local varieties historically, to your area as well, aren't you? And I think all of that kind of thing and an awareness of it is really important.
I think there's a kind of rebellion in it. I quite enjoy kind of, I think there's a sort of, subversion that goes along with seed sovereignty, and that really appeals to me
Yeah, I get that. I get that. That's cool. So,
in a small scale way.
so Flint corn then, Flint corn. Am I right? And this is something that I've researched a little bit with a view to making my own flour, corn flour, which is something I'm intensely interested in doing at some point. Flint corn, is it a case that if you have any Flint corn variety, you can then use it for popping corn or corn flour, or are there certain varieties within Flint corn that you use for one or the other, or how does it work? I'm a real novice. I'm a blank canvas when it comes to Flint corn.
We are blind leading the blind here because I don't know for sure. So you're going to have to rely on people commenting
Sure.
back to find out.
Yeah,
I,
yeah.
to my understanding, I do like to kind of research things as I go with them. But to my understanding, if it's a flint corn, it can be popped and or it can be ground into flour. I
Yeah.
think if our product is successful and we get quite a good harvest, I'd love to have a go at both, just to kind of, again, for myself and for the girls, that kind of educational kind of experience of seeing what that looks like and how you go about doing it.
Yeah.
But that was my understanding, is that that's what the kind of divide is. If it's sweet corn, you can just eat it straight, or if it's a flint corn, then people say it's only good for, like, it's kind of second rate. You hear
Yeah.
that comment a lot. Oh, it's only good for grinding into flour or popping, and I'm like,
Yeah.
those are brilliant things.
Amazing, yeah. Amazing. So I think the other one definite benefit to growing Flint corn, if you've got the space, I regret that we're not growing any this year. We're growing two blocks of sweet corn, just because of my September challenge. I thought I'd want to have quite a lot of that. And also my kids absolutely love it. I couldn't grow enough sweet corn here unless I was growing, one of my, if I gave one of my paddocks over to it, then maybe we'd meet the demand. But one of the sort of amazing things about Flint corn is, from a homesteading point of view, if you want to learn a new skill, you've got that side of it. You've got the corn flour and the popping corn and, some things to play with in the kitchen, which for me is a huge turn on and something I'm really excited by. But also you've got, coupled with that, you've got the longevity of the processing. So with our sweet corn, obviously once we pick it, we're going to be eating it probably that same hour. Whereas, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the flint corn, you're going to basically leave it on the plant to basically dry in situ, I would think, at least partly before probably finishing off the drying somewhere in the house. But then you've got the rest of your lives to process it, so you can come back to it when perhaps you're not quite so busy in the garden.
Exactly, yes. I think it stores really well. So we'll probably dry it out and then store it in a big kiln or jar or something, and then use it as we want to. But equally, I think then you can seed save that and you can grow again from it for next year. So it's really quite an exciting crop if you're, like say, if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The other thing is there's a kind of artsy side to it as well. So I've seen people braiding the silks to make it look like little fairy heads, which is really weird and cute. Mm-hmm. I quite like that. That appeals to me. But also you can use the kernels themselves, because they are so beautiful and iridescent. You can use that for decorations for like kind of Halloween and that time of year. So there's a lot of creativity that surrounds that one produce.
Yeah. Well, I know the pasta art that kids do. You know, I imagine you could do a much more beautiful Roman mosaic type piece of art with your fantastically coloured flint corn. I think that would be a really great project for the kids.
That's a rainy day activity if ever I heard one. We're definitely going to do that now.
So we've been talking about corn for quite a while, a little bit more than I'd anticipated. But what we actually previously discussed about talking about today were things that we've almost killed, wasn't it? Yes, not friends.
No.
But before we leave the corn behind, I just want to, I'm going to be a bit cheeky, and I'm going to say, Julie, I would be absolutely over the moon if you have enough spare to possibly have some of your seed corn for my own garden next year or the year after, if you'd be prepared to spare me some. And of course I'll cover the postage and what have you, but if you've got enough spare, if that sounds like something you'd be willing to share with me, I think that'd be amazing.
I will swap you some Egyptian walking onions.
Sounds perfect. So I just want to take a moment and say thank you. Thank you for listening. I really, really appreciate every single one of you who downloads and listens to the show. There's lots of ways that you can help the show grow and support it. And probably one of the best ones is just to share it with someone. Find someone who you think might be interested in this content and say, listen, here's a show that I like. I think you might like it too. And point them in our direction. We would be forever grateful. If you want to go a step further, you could also become a patron. You can do that by going to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub and set up to donate a small monthly amount. If you think this podcast is worth the price of a cup of coffee a month, then you can set it at that amount. And obviously, anyone who chooses to do that, we are eternally grateful to. So, things you've almost killed.
A few of them.
Where do you want to start?
We start? Oh, you know what? I want to say globe artichokes, but actually I'd like to start further back. I'd like to start with tomatoes last year, because I have a success story. So I feel like it has an ultimate happy ending. So last year, a bit of context. I was very ill with pneumonia and I was in hospital for a period of time. And aside from the kind of the life crisis that was, there was also a very immediate seedling situation.
Even more important.
Perspective, you know. So my husband Justin and my kids were sort of left at home going, oh, what's going on? And they saw that all my seedlings in the dining room window were beginning to get a bit, you know, too big for their pots. So I think as an activity to probably just distract themselves, to be honest, because it was a really difficult time. Yeah. They thought would do a really good thing, and they would pop them on for me, for which they've never been allowed to forget it. Because I was growing several different varieties of tomato.
I think I know where this is going.
And some of them, I mean, we're talking like young children, right? So
Yeah.
some of them were vine varieties, and some of them were tumbling ones that I was going to put into my hanging basket.
Yep.
And halfway through, Justin realized that the system that he thought he had ceased to exist, because the nickname that we have for Serafina, but she's not aware of, is chaos theory, because she just brings the chaos theory. You think you've
Yeah.
got stuff organized, and she just undoes it somehow.
Yeah, she is the butterfly.
Oh my gosh, every time, and she's
Yeah.
gorgeous, but yeah, we find ourselves undone quite often. So all the labels suddenly were rendered pointless, and they had no idea what was what. And when I came out of hospital, we were all just grateful I was alive, quite frankly. And I was incredibly grateful to them for having done it, because otherwise the plants probably wouldn't have survived. But then we had a summer of fun trying to work out, or the spring especially, trying to work out what was what. And
And
I had
where
all,
it needs to go.
yeah, exactly, because I had plans for everything. They couldn't all just go, they weren't just interchangeable because we're all vine varieties. They weren't. So I was there kind of studying them, thinking about their growth pattern, trying to figure it all out. And I thought I had it sussed. And I was like, yes, I'm really confident now. It's really clear the distinction between those ones and these ones.
Yeah.
I don't think I had a clue. I really didn't. I don't think I even got it kind of like opposite way round. I think it was just a complete mess.
Wow. Wow.
So stuff got planted, and then within a month, when it was too late to do anything about it, we began to go, oh no, that's definitely not what that was. So we had vine varieties in the hanging basket. Pride of place at the front of the house.
Yeah.
They didn't survive. They died really, really quickly. Also, I'm shocking when it comes to watering. So a hanging basket plant has to be the right thing to be able to
Yeah.
cope with me and my intermittent watering. So no, there came a point kind of midsummer where they were just sticks, and they were not happy sticks. It was awful, really. Like, that was my biggest failure, I think, was those hanging baskets last year. I felt like apologizing to the postman, because he was the only person coming to the door, so but yeah, that was shocking. And then in the greenhouse, the sort of opposite happened. There were vine tomatoes, there were bush variety tomatoes, and I didn't know which was which. So I wasn't shaping them, like taking out the side shoots, because I didn't know if I should. And I wasn't staking them. I just had this huge sprawl. But actually, despite that, got a really, really good harvest, even though it was my best effort to kind of just mistreat them and kill them off. I managed, out of the greenhouse, we actually did all right for harvest. Whereas this year, we took great pains to get it right, and I'm really surprised at myself. I've got tumblers that are fruiting and are just turning now. And
Brilliant.
if I can just keep up the watering, they'll
Yeah.
get there, but I'm still not convinced that I will. So we'll see.
Yeah. But do you feel like all that studying of the seedlings, did you, was there any payoff to that in the end? Do you feel like you've learned anything about how tomatoes grow, or was it completely just wasted effort?
No, it wasn't completely wasted effort. It was fun. It taught me humility.
Yeah.
I made what I thought were really educated guesses, and I was wrong. And that's quite healthy to have that happen to you occasionally.
Yeah,
So
happens to me
that was
all the
fine.
time.
Yeah, personal growth was great. Tomato growth, not so
Not
much.
so much. I
But
found I found
sorry.
with the cordon tomatoes, I have found, and I'm just admitting this to myself. Now, I suppose admitting it to myself might be the wrong way of putting it. I think I'm just now confident myself to sort of come out and go against the prevailing wisdom and say, I think that all of the trimming and pinching out and everything else, if you've got the space to get to the fruit and you're willing to operate within a jungle, I just think you just get better yields by doing so much less than what is instructed on the tin, if you like. You know, if you go for the real, this is just my opinion, but I'm finally confident enough in it now to kind of share it with the world, that I think if you go with the, you know, the RHS, this is how you do it, the perfect way of growing a vining tomato, I just don't think you get anywhere near the yields that you get if you, so long as your soil's up to it, so long as you've got the nutrients in the ground for them, if you just let them go, I think you get far greater yield. It's just a bit more work actually cropping them, and you know, things become a bit unkempt, and they will take over literally the whole greenhouse if you let them. But
yeah, I'm completely in agreement, and that really was the lesson, actually. I was going to say exactly that, was that, but I kind of skipped it. I didn't get there through confidence. I got there through just it happened, and I went, yeah, that worked.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you see, like, the likes of Charles Dowding, who, you know, is a bit of a kind of an icon in, like, the growing community, yeah, and is meticulous about, this is the way that you support the plant, this is the way that you prune the plant, and it has to be exactly this number of stems and so on. And for some people, that's great. They like that neat and tidy militant way. Yeah. I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to waste my time on it, because, like you said, I've learned through a really big mistake, but I did learn that actually they just want a fruit anyway, and I don't need it to look tidy, because, you know, it's just for me, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's, you get a bit of a sprawl. I guess where people might be a bit concerned is if you don't have enough airflow, then you're going to get risk of disease and so on. And I get that as well. But I think you can fix that if you see that becoming a problem.
I was about to say, I definitely cut back any stems that have got yellowing leaves on or whatever, they're gone.
Yeah, you know, keep it clean and tidy. Yeah.
And a lot of the lower leaves as well, anything touching the ground, gone. But other than that, I'm inclined to, you know, let them go.
Yeah, no, I'm quite a convert to that now. In fact, well, also this year, we didn't put any in the greenhouse. I made way for different plants. I've gone for aubergines and cucumbers and chilies and stuff in there. So, because we don't have a big space, our greenhouse is 6 foot by 6 foot, which is tiny, but I think I make really good use of that space. I think our planning is good. We've got two really big, deep beds either side as you go in, which are no dig, straight into the ground. And they get huge amounts of compost each year, so that they work really, really well. And then across the back, we've got like a table that's two tiered, but you can take the table out and leave a frame, and then you can grow stuff up through it in pots. And I found that actually for the size of space we've got, we make use of every single bit of it. But that good said, food. it's still small. So this year, all the tomato plants have had to fend for themselves elsewhere in the garden. Mm-hmm. But the majority of them are still straight into the ground. And I think that makes a big difference for them. It certainly saves them from my poor watering habits. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, we plant our tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers and everything straight into the ground in the polytunnels. And I just, the less I need to be involved in the watering, the better for everyone involved. You know, the plants particularly, they do so much better with nature watering them than me watering them, even in the polytunnel, because in the ground, people sometimes forget that, you know, that still has access to the moisture that's falling in the ground around the greenhouse and around the polytunnel. So
I've noticed that it really seems to draw in still, and it's a lot more forgiving. It really is much more forgiving growing that way, I'm finding. And like I said, you know your own kind of, you know, failings, and one of mine is definitely keeping up with watering. Justin's amazing at watering. He'll go out and do it in the evenings for me. I feel, I always get a pang of guilt, but not enough to take over.
that's the perfect amount of guilt, Julie.
It's like, oh yeah, I ought to be doing that. It's great he's doing it for me. That's nice.
Perfect amount of guilt. Any more and it starts to affect your life. Fantastic.
So I pull my weight in other ways. It's fine.
Of course. Of course. So that's tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go to the artichokes next?
Yeah, can do. It's a bit of a mystery. And you know what? I'd love it if anybody who's listening who has experience of artichokes can, comment back at some point, because I would
And
love
I
to
will just
know.
sec I will second that, because this is a plant that you and I are both struggling with. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, no, I don't understand it. So, I've got some ideas of where I might have gone wrong, but equally it may not be me. I'm just assuming that it is. So we've got a new bed that we began to establish end of last year as a no dig bed. So basically everything we do, we just chuck down cardboard and crack on. So this is sort of southeast facing, and it backs onto a privet hedge. So we know that's kind of taking a lot of nutrients out of the ground, and it obviously makes it a bit drier because it's a big hedge. But we chucked a load of chicken manure and compost down on that ground, and it's clay soil, but not too compacted there. And this is our first year growing them. I got them as seedlings, as plug plants from somebody, I don't know, is it Victorian Nursery? Something like that. It's got that sort of sounding name online. But basically, got three globe artichoke plug plants, and I probably was too eager and put them straight in the ground. And maybe because of the spring we had, I should have kept them in the greenhouse for a few weeks. I don't think I even hardened them off. It's definitely my fault. The more I think about this, yeah, retracing my steps here. Yeah, okay, I could have put them in the greenhouse. I could have hardened them off slowly. I could have potted them on first to build up their root system. But aside from that, I can't understand where I've gone wrong. So, I planted them out. They fended themselves. They looked fine. I didn't see any sort of signs of root shock or anything. But that was months ago, and we've had all kinds of weather since. We've had sunshine. We've had heat. We've had rain. We water that bed pretty well. What's happening is it'll grow. Each one of them is doing the same thing. They'll grow a second leaf that will just come out. And once it gets to a good size, the first leaf sort of shrivels and disappears. And then the next leaf will come out. And when it gets to a good size, the previous leaf sort of shrivels and disappears. And we can't seem to get them past that size, that growth point. I put some sheep's wool that I foraged in the Peak District about a month ago. I put that around the base of them to try and deter slugs in case it was slugs that's interfering. I think actually a lot of it is disturbance from the garden birds kind of scratch about and love to peck in that border. So I think they're kind of like probably, I don't know, irritating the plant somehow, scratching and pecking near it. So I don't know, I've got all these ideas of what may have happened, but I truly don't know. All I know is I have a massive gap in the middle of that bed that was meant to be my pride of place this year, because they're such huge plants. I made sure with my planting, but I left plenty of room around them. So now everything is looking really nice in that border for its first year. Next year it should improve. Except for this really weird, obvious gap in the middle. And I just want to put a sign in it again for the postman to explain what
Yeah,
happened.
just so you're aware.
It's like, I know. This is probably the oddest front garden in the neighborhood anyway. I get it, but I want you to understand what's gone wrong here.
Yes, just to the left of the cornfield, you will see. Well, I've got similar troubles with my globe artichokes. When we moved in here, there were two or three established plants in the garden, and they were doing really well. But they weren't where I wanted them. So what I did, or we haven't touched them, but what I did, I took some seeds and propagated them and grew my own seedlings. And this is, 2 or 3 years ago now. And I grew about, I had a fantastic germination rate. I probably sowed 20 seeds and I had maybe 17 germinate. And not a single one of those plants made it to maturity. And I don't know if perhaps they weren't pollinated properly. I don't know if that's a thing. But anyway, throughout this process, while I was doing this, the parent plants actually died. They just died. And I've
Oh
no idea
no.
why. Yeah. Now, what I do know, even though they were established plants, they were transplanted here just before we moved in. So they were, mature plants a few feet tall, but they weren't, but they'd only recently been transplanted. So for whatever reason, they died. And then, so they all died. And then last spring, I picked up two new globe artichoke plants at the side of a road. Someone was selling them outside their house, and I bought them and I brought them home, and they went through the year and they got to a couple of feet tall and did really well. I didn't harvest from them. I left them to sort of do their thing and establish for a year. And over the winter, one of them's died, and the one that's back now is doing okay, and it's got leaves on it, but it's just, it's not thriving, and it doesn't look like it's going to fruit this year. And I just have no idea what's going on. And I'm on heavy clay. I don't know if it's that, and we
maybe
have had,
it's the soil.
I think it might be. And we've had, you know, throughout this time, we've had lots of periods of heavy rain where we have had waterlogged ground. And that's really, in my head, that was the only thing I could possibly think it could be. But I just, I'm at the point where I'm thinking, well, maybe I will just give up with globe artichokes. But it seems a shame because...
No, you want to keep going.
Well, they are.
You want to win.
Of course. But they're an edible perennial, you know.
This is it. In theory, once you've got them, they should just be this lovely smug plant that you grow and you don't have to do much with, and it provides for you. You know, that's the whole point of them. I don't know, unless it might be easier to get a cutting from somebody else's mature plant. Because I think it's really sad that your existing ones, even after you took the seed from them, that they died, because it would have been an easier thing then for you to take a cutting from them and propagate that way, you know, because that's another way that you can reproduce, isn't it, from globe artichokes.
I don't know. This is news to me.
Yeah, you can.
A leaf cutting, or...
I don't know the details that much, because I've not gotten that far.
Sure, but it can be propagated from cuttings.
You can propagate from cuttings. I think it's a bit like perennial kale is another one. I have got a perennial kale. I did get as a plug plant this year from Sarah at, Half Acre Farm. Mm-hmm. And that came through the post, and that's doing amazingly well. So and that's in the same bed, just further along. So I'm thinking... I'm getting something right there, at least, because it is really flourishing, looking really good and healthy. So I felt like, well, if that's doing well, why isn't this? Because it feels like it should be happy in the same space, but maybe it isn't. Maybe I've just got that wrong.
So talk to me about that bed, though, because you've got some really interesting plans there, and it sounds like you've got some amazing plants going in there.
It's quite experimental, and it's based off nothing but my own feeling of why not. Mm-hmm. So that the theory is that to anybody, and again, it's just the postman who visits in this day and age, but to anybody who comes into our garden, you would look at that border and you'd go, that's a very beautiful herbaceous border. That's, you know, to the untrained eye, that's what I want people to see, is a really nice kind of quite aesthetically pleasing design. It's got a big curved kind of wavy front edge to it, and it goes up against a big privet hedge, so which is now incredibly difficult to cut back, as we discovered. We've cut it back once and we won't do it again until the autumn, because we've planted in front of it. Nightmare. But anyway, it was worth it. It was absolutely worth doing. So predominantly we want it to be perennials, but we also want to have annuals in there. So we've got in one shady corner, which was, I'm really proud of this actually, it's already working. It was a naff corner, there's nothing happening in it, even grass wouldn't grow there. My dog just liked to run up to it and bark into the hedge. that's one of her favourite pastimes. And I want to stop her doing that as well, so I need to plant something big and chunky in there. And my neighbour on one side, she gifted us the rhubarb that was growing in her garden. She decided she didn't want to keep it anymore. So I went round with a probably wrong time of year, late spring, with the wheelbarrow and loads of water and a spade, and I got it out of the ground and replanted it. I split it as well. It needed dividing. And I thought, it's a wrong time of year, it may not work, I'm putting it in a shady corner, the jury's out on if that's a good idea, rhubarb or not. And it is absolutely flourishing. I think I might get a harvest from it next year. And it's filling that corner up, and it just seems really happy there. It only gets evening sun, but it's just thriving. So that's a win. That's something that's worked.
Yeah.
And that's surrounded by A fern, a hosta, a couple of different grasses. So things that are just ornamental and are appropriate for that kind of growing environment in that corner, because otherwise nothing else is going to be happy there. And then further along, this isn't working well yet, but it will, I'm determined. I'm planting asparagus into that bed as well. I've got a couple of clumps, and in another bed that's a corner bed near the kitchen door, I've got a clump at the back of that bed as well. And my reason is I don't like the idea of asparagus having to take up a designated space forevermore, like a whole regimented bed of asparagus that needs to be tended and looks rubbish for the rest of the year. That doesn't appeal to me very much. It was a bit of confirmation bias, if I'm honest. I was seeking out, and it was hard to find, examples where people are successfully growing asparagus interplanted in mixed borders. And I found like one or two examples online of people doing that. And I was like, aha, there, proof it can be done. So that was all I needed to then, be brave and put those out there. But again, those are from plug plants, and I should have given them more time to mature before I put them out. I really ought to have done. So they've had a bit of a rough start, but they are fighting back. I think they got a bit of slug damage early on, but they are coming back. So I just need to be patient with those, let them get established, not plant anything else too close to them to give them a bit of space and a chance to, build strength and a good root system. But then the idea is I'll be able to harvest those, in spring when they're ready for cropping. And then after that, I'll let those ferns go up and let them go to seed, and they'll be a nice textural addition to the back of the border. So again, it's kind of about making sure that everything is functional, but it's also beautiful and adding to that whole look. So that's quite brave, and I don't know yet. I'll tell you in like 3 years' time if that works.
For sure.
That's a long-term project, but it's fun. I'm just playing. I really am just playing with that border. And then there's the globe artichokes, which are the centerpiece, but they're not because there's a big gap. And then there's more asparagus, and then we've got that perennial kale. And again, that's a plant which I can take cuttings from and propagate if I want to. It's an everlasting plant, theoretically.
Well, I was going to ask, perennial kale, is it a true perennial, as in it will go on for decades, or is it like a there are a lot of perennial plants that are sort of they say the actual life of them is 3 to 5 years sort of
I
thing.
think it's more like that because globe artichokes are the same, aren't they? They say about 5 years, and then you'd want to propagate from them and take cuttings. I think perennial kale is the same. But it's like with strawberries, though. With strawberries, you've got like a 3 year cycle, and then you want to kind of take the runners. So in my head, it sort of occupies the same sort of kind of space, like in terms of how you look after them. But yeah, as long as you could take a cutting before you kill the old one, then you can keep on going forever, I guess.
Yeah, for
So yeah,
sure.
but it should be in once it's established, it's going to take a bit of time. I think that's a bed that should be quite low effort. It should look after itself. But then there's gaps in between where I'm putting things like I've got aubergines, peppers, chilies, lots of different tomatoes, basil. I've got a herb garden area on one of those borders near the kitchen, which is doing really well actually. So I'm not killing everything. I'm not killing everything. I'm killing a decent balance of stuff, I think.
Yeah, a decent balance of killing with surviving, which is what we're after.
Yeah. But I think some of that comes out of experimentation, and I'm okay with that now. I think I'm not so hard on myself now.
Well, what I would say, and I genuinely mean this for me, and this isn't for everyone. This isn't for everyone at all, and it's down to personality and mindsets. But I would always say, if you're not making mistakes, then you're not trying enough new things. You're not pushing yourself. You're not experimenting enough. If everything was going right, that just means I wasn't experimenting enough. I wasn't, really
You got
pushing
comfortable.
what was possible. And then there's wins that I've missed out on by being too safe. If nothing's going wrong, then I've been too safe, and there's wins available to me that I haven't, you know, being able to capitalize on.
And on the flip side, it's nice to have some things that are comfortable and ticking along in the background to allow you that space and freedom to experiment and play, really.
Yeah. For sure. If you're playing a sport, if you're scoring 100% of the shots you're taking, you're not taking enough shots.
I like that.
Well, there you go. I think that brings us full circle and sort of draws a line under the Globe Artichokes and everything. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that you've nearly killed, Julie? Or is that
anything else that I've killed? Oh, there's been some strawberries, but I don't think that was my fault. So that's, yeah, because we're trying to grow strawberries, but not in a traditional patch. A lot of what we're doing, we're trying to make best use of the space rather than having everything in very kind of obvious marked out beds. Mm-hmm. So we are, you know, those big fence pots that you can get from B&Q that just hook onto the fence.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We have an army of those, like a regiment all along the back fence. And that has half worked, but I think it comes down to variety, but it also comes down to the quality of the plants that I got in the post. So I've noticed that some of them have worked really well, and I've got a few pots that are looking very empty. So so I think I should probably take those pots down and make it look like I've been really successful, but I haven't. I've left them up. But I'll just buy more next year until I've got that ultimate number, and then I'll start taking the runners and I'll be self-sufficient in those as well.
Yeah, strawberries are just a really, once you're up and running, they're a really really easy plant to kind of just stay up and running with. And traditionally they would have been in a raised bed. They would be, you know, in old Victorian gardens, they'd be in usually a masonry brick bed on the side of the greenhouse, wouldn't they, or something like that. So
yeah, exactly, which is beautiful. And I think I would like to have a patch of them, but I've just lost you a little bit there.
Oh, sorry, Siri wanted to. Siri had an opinion on strawberries.
Siri had an opinion. Yeah, I'm sure Siri has all the answers.
Yeah, well, I told Siri that we're not that interested at the moment. So, sorry, carry on.
I have no idea what I was going to say now. It's not a problem, though.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you wanted to say before we wrap up, Julie?
No, I think we're all good. Yeah, happy with that.
Well, as always, thank you so much for coming on today, and stay in touch, and we'll speak again very, very soon.
Thank you. And I'll try really hard not to kill that glass gem corn for you.
Yeah, please. And last thing, before we go, do you want to point people towards where they can find you?
Oh, yeah, of course. So we are on with a Facebook page, and we have an Instagram account, and we have a YouTube channel, and our handle is Elegant Sufficiency UK.
Perfect. Cheers, Julie.
Well, thank you.
If you find this podcast valuable, there's several ways you can support it. The easiest of which is to rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. You could also talk about it or share it wherever you post online, including your social media pages. And now you can support the podcast directly by becoming a patron at patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. However you support the podcast, we really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. See you soon.